It's great, man. So welcome, everybody. Welcome to the second episode of Founders Focus today. We've got a doubleheader, and it's episode 19. And I'm delighted to continue this series because I find it's fascinating to talk to entrepreneurs that are so annoyed at a recruiting problem that they go ahead and think it's a good idea to try and set up a company to build technology to try and fix that problem. I find that to be like a remarkable situation. And we can learn so much from the people that go ahead and take this type of risk. So I'm delighted to bring on my guest today. Brain Food sponsor, it's Troy Sultan at Guide. Troy, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm pumped.
You are indeed. And we need to just go straight in with the big news, man, because about 45 minutes before we launched this, there was like a huge announcement. So I just wanted maybe to take a step back and allow you to tell us what's happened over the last 24 hours for you guys.
Yeah, we're quite excited. We just announced an $8 million seed round led by First Round Capital, Spiro Ventures, and a number of others. And that announcement went live in TechCrunch and a few other places this morning. And so we're fielding a fair amount of excitement. It just means a lot as a business that's gone through multiple iterations and is at an inflection point in culture, I think, and recruiting now, where the candidate is coming into power and what we're working on today seems so prescient for some of the pain that we feel as candidates in the market and aligning those incentives with companies. So we're just really excited to kind of get back to work, and we've got the backing to do it now.
It's a thrilling. Firstly, congratulations on the raise. That's amazing to do it. And I feel really fortunate that, you know, you're spending the time with us right now. You should be speaking to people of a much bigger audience and what have you. I'm really delighted to have this conversation. How does it feel as the founder of the business to have got to the point where, you know, you've got some significant backing from some of the elite sort of VC funds out there, that kind of confidence that they have in what you're doing? How does that make you feel as the founder of the business?
It's gratifying, certainly. I think, though, the paradox of like foundership is you kind of got to believe for quite a while when nobody else doesn't. No matter how good the business is, right? I think most companies kind of have to face headwinds for a while. And that's kind of why the business tends not to exist when you go found it, right? Because it's unobvious and it's counterintuitive usually. And so, we've gotten used to that certainly for probably too many years. It really does feel good both to have really great backers behind us, but for our team and the folks have been doing so much work for so long to have the sort of external validation. It's nice. It's certainly not our primary motivator, but it's nice to be able to give mom the TechCrunch post and let her know that I wasn't nuts for quitting my job.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is part of the thing, isn't it? Because when founders go and do these types of risks, there's all other kinds of things you've got to think about: the opportunity cost, the family around you. There has to be some doubt. Of course, it's a risk, and the risk is still there because, hey, it's a raise, it's a significant raise, but that's not the end of the journey by any means. I'm sure you would agree with this, but it is validation at least that you've got external people looking at this and thinking, you know what, that's a horse worth backing. Fantastic to see that happen. Sitting with this just a little bit longer, because I think people that kind of pay attention to Founders Focus, I think, have a little bit of a view that they may want to make this journey themselves at some point. How do you feel about the fundraising sort of journey? Like, how early in the starting of this business was the fundraise one of the things you wanted to do? And did you have a plan around it? And how did you execute to bring it home to this point now?
Yeah, great questions. I think, as was sort of stated on some of the pretext for this conversation, I started my career in recruiting and was leading recruiting at a startup and kind of made the leap from that world into starting a business. And rather than going the route of raising capital myself initially, I actually just started consulting. And so our business today is actually kind of a mutation of a sort of totally different foreign object that we started with, 6 years ago, 7 years ago now almost. And I started where I knew I could provide value, which was really putting butts in seats inside of companies as a contingent recruiter. And I used that to finance the early learning, even though we knew we wanted to move into software. And so as we grew that, I worked with companies specifically who I said, hey, look, I'm looking to build a software business. I'm going to deliver value to you as you need it today, but I'm also going to poke around and ask some funky questions. And because here's my ulterior motive, and you got to be okay with that. And so that filtered for great clients in the beginning. And we worked with just a few who let me go really deep, and that started kind of everything.
That is amazing. I didn't actually know that was the journey. And I can be pretty confident that there's not many people have done that track where you've worked basically as an internal recruiter, and then you popped out to work as a service provider, as a consultant, with, as you say, the explicit ulterior motive to say, you know what, the aim of this is actually to build some software and to deliver a scalable solution, but in the interim, we're also going to hire a bunch of cool people for you. So I love that attitude, man. That's outstanding. Okay, let's rewind back to, you know, your recruiting days. So you worked internally with Agusha. I think you worked with Google as well for a period. During that journey, like, did you have an inkling as to the sort of problem, sort of the domain that you wanted to solve within recruiting?
I would say not the one within recruiting, but certainly very early on that recruiting was the umbrella. And I both said this personally to myself, partially in secrecy at the time, but certainly to our team at every stage of our evolution, which was, we're really married to the problem, not the solution. And that's to say that, like, the ways in which this umbrella of problems might be solved over time will evolve and change. And it certainly has for us. I knew that there were a myriad of problems under the recruiting umbrella that I felt could be improved when I was leading the talent function, but I really didn't have any idea what I had no vision for the solution. I was really wanting to, my approach, and everybody does this differently, was to just entrench myself in the problem until the solution punched me in the face.
Yeah,
or the first one. And that's certainly what ended up happening during our consulting days. Actually, quite quickly, and like months into that consulting journey, we got our first inkling of where to start.
Yeah, that's a really interesting approach. It's like kind of like immersion into the problem, right? Almost like immersion learning. So you're not like bringing in frameworks, you're not bringing in like concepts per se, you're just literally getting into the job. And I think one of the advantages you might have is that you were doing the job. So, you know, you could experiencing it from a consultant point of view, but you can also experience it from an operational point of view as a contributor. So, you know, there's some really deep sort of experience there that I think it would be lacking for a lot of folks. So I can already see that this may be like one of the advantages that you might have to be able to spot this gap and think, you know what, that's the area we're going to shoot at. And as you say, guide is a mutation, right? It basically is like there was multiple things happening. You saw this thing. And then because you had sort of the flexibility, you were able to essentially lean into an opportunity that's obviously on a massive track right now. So can you take us through a little bit about how Guide emerged as a brand separate from the stuff you were doing before?
Yeah. So a quick take on the evolution. If there are people in the audience who are in recruiting and are hungry for a path potentially to their own business, whether by way of a consultancy or software, like, I can kind of talk about the couple pillars of our sort of journey, which was, we started consulting and we started hearing the same thing, which is every company felt that they were great at closing candidates. What the data looked like, we can talk about another time, but they all would agree that they had a problem at the top of the funnel. They'd all say the same thing. We're amazing. Once candidates meet us,
they love
close,
you. Yeah, yeah. Totally.
We can't get enough of the right people in the top of the funnel. So we started to focus there, and we very quickly basically built a business that we called Sourcing as a Service. So we actually employed a team of sourcers all over the world that would source for a given role. And then we would connect into the email address of like the founders of that startup or the hiring managers. And then we'd do all the research, targeting, and they'd write the message and plug in their email. And then we'd trigger sourcing emails to these candidates on their behalf. They would go to sleep in the morning, you know, at night, and wake up in the morning. They'd have a bunch of replies in their inbox saying, hey, this sounds awesome, I'd love to chat. We'd be invisible, an invisible arm of the hiring manager. And we, so this kind of took the middleman of the recruiter out of the way. and then enabled companies to own the candidate experience, which they seem to have a hunger for. And so that was our sort of that was our wedge in. That grew quite quickly as well, and started to grow quite quick. But we actually needed to operationalize the business, so we started building software internally for our sourcing team to do their job quicker. And that was basically like a button click from a GitHub profile or LinkedIn that brought the profile in, that automatically triggered the email on behalf of the customer, found the email address. And one of our customers at one point, 6 months into that journey, as it was growing, said, why the hell don't I have this software for my internal recruiting team, which we were augmenting at the time? Why don't my sourcers have the access to this button that they can click and trigger the emails? And we were like, would you pay for it? And they're like, well, we were paying $600 for ConnectFire at the time. So, you know, we'd pay this. And so we went heads down for a month and shipped that. And that became our outreach and CRM platform resource, which we then built to over a million ARR business, serving, you know, over 100 organizations across the globe. Building the outreach and CRM layer, we were competing with the likes of Gem and Interstellar and such. And we ended up at that point, a couple years into that journey, really starting to see what we called the InMail problem, which was, you know, as more people come to use InMail, the less effective it gets. In the early days, it was really effective. And then the sort of curve goes like this, and you look for other ways to differentiate. So we asked, what's it going to look like when every company on the planet is using email and email automation to outreach? Well, what then? When the candidate's getting 10 emails with a drip campaign, you know, how do you differentiate? Is this going to be a game of writing better copy? And so we started really thinking about the bigger picture that got us much more excited than what we were working on at the time, which was how do we solve the problem and think about the problem, not as reaching candidates? We could do that today with a click of a button. It's pretty easy, actually. It's fairly solved, we'd argue. The problem, we believe, is actually winning the candidate. And that's a big shift. So now it's about communication and storytelling and exposing and illustrating our culture, communicating what it's actually like to work here. What is this opportunity? That got us like totally fired up. And so a year into like a Skunkworks project in our own company, we productized a process that we were running ourselves when we were a 10-person startup at Resource with no brand, no money, no resources. And we were hiring some incredible people. And the way that we were doing that was like rolling out the red carpet during the interview process. We had a series of Google Docs that let them know exactly what was going on, what to expect, who they were meeting. And we ended up just productizing effectively that concept to enable companies now to deliver a hyper-transparent interview experience. So candidates know exactly what they're getting all along the way. And they have a home base to live with all of the information they need to prepare. And then we pipe back analytics on how what candidates are engaging with, what they're most exciting about, back to the company so they can provide an even more personalized experience all throughout. So that was kind of the high level like anatomy of what went down. Of course, I ate a lot of Tylenol along the way, and it wasn't as straightforward as it sounds.
You know what? I'm like super impressed the more I speak with you, Troy, because it seems that you're able to kind of understand a position of strength, but still have a sense that you could do better. So you had like $1 million recurring revenue business doing the sourcing side. You grew that into, that wasn't satisfactory. You thought you'd create a software product and sold that to 100 companies. That wasn't satisfactory. You exited that and then produced Guide. And I guess this is not satisfactory at some point either. So I love the scaling ambition going forward, man. This is awesome.
That's why I call it a mutation.
It is. But you know what? I think that attitude is really healthy to cultivate because sometimes you can like rest on your laurels a little bit and think, okay, I can sit on this and I can be comfortable. And, you know, here we've made this plateau. I'll take a break for a little while. But like you say, it's like sometimes you need to have the fire to really like mobilize all of your resources. I think the concept of Guide is pretty unique, which is just to, and I'll let you kind of tell your own story in a bit more detail, Troy, but to summarize from a layman's perspective, basically what it is, it's an online portal where a recruiting business or an employer is able to simply upload information about how the recruiting process works, and then the candidate can basically see how it works and then track their progress through it, which removes the black hole, the resume black hole, the concern about what's going on, who's going to happen, who's interviewing, when am I interviewed, how many people in process, all of that disappears through the portal. And I think this is a very, very powerful implementation of a problem we all know is a problem, but no one's kind of had the way to figure it out. How do we fix this? We don't know. Do we send like a bunch of mass texts or something? No, just provide one place where all of it is housed. And you also, by using the portal kind of as a shared space, I think you force employers to suddenly go transparent, don't you? That's the beauty of it, because you can't work with Guide unless you're going to tell the system how your recruiting process works.
Precisely. I think that's one of the things we're most excited about, is one of the harder things to do in software, in my view, is actually change behavior. And it's really hard to change behavior when in a way that benefits everyone involved. And so in a way that we view this problem is, we have a chance to sort of start with companies who are hyper transparent or want to be, but are going through a lot of pain to do so. They're creating one pagers and PDFs and lengthy email templates, and they're sending that pre-interview text message to prep the candidate. They're going through a lot of motion to proactively keep people up to date on where they're at in the process and how to be successful, without them sitting in anxiety or imagination or wonder in an opaque experience, which creates a lot of negative emotion. And in doing that, we can bring those companies into a world where they can do all this with one click in a highly visual, real-time way that brings the power of the web to them with analytics and other things. But it also sets an example for how much more effective of a recruiting process and how much you can improve your win rates, how much candidates actually truly are driven more to your company when you do this. And that means that the companies that are less used to being transparent or are less like comfortable with the idea, it's sort of an old model where this was a black box and it worked then, they can see that this is something that's worth taking a risk on, because the results aren't just for the candidate. The results, this is the beauty, it's the more transparency we're learning, the more companies are able to win. And it's also relating, we're starting to see towards some things like retention, for example, because there's more information shared in the interview process, candidates are able to make a more informed decision, or vice versa. We're in a world where when a candidate learns what it's actually like to work there, and at that point they decide not to opt in to your company because they've learned something that's not going to be a fit for them, that's actually a huge win for the company. That means that they avoided partnering with the wrong person that was going to find that out in month two, and was going to leave then in a much more expensive scenario. And so this transparency really does help both parties, but it is quite a new concept that I think as an industry, we're still getting used to.
Transparency is trust. It's as simple as that. And it doesn't even matter what the process is or even what the culture is. Like, part of my kind of annoyance at the description of so-called toxic cultures is that, sure, it's toxic for a bunch of people, maybe for a lot of people, but not for everybody. It's quite possible that somebody would be really happy working in what you call a toxic culture because it's not toxic to them. The most important thing is you're not disguising what that is. It's like, here is how this company is, here's how they recruit. You as a candidate can self-select yourself in or out based on that information. It's informed consent. Whereas outside of this type of framework, if we're truthful, you see an ad out on the web somewhere, it's kind of misinformed consent, so to speak. Because I'm applying to some marketing literature. I know it's marketing literature. You know it's marketing literature. I'm going to respond with marketing literature with my resume, and then two parties who've basically been deceptive to each other are going to try and sit down in some sort of meeting and also then continue to be deceptive. And we wonder at the end of this process, like, why have we not got the hiring right? It's because basically we've spent an entire process lying to each other. Of course we haven't got it right, you know? So I totally get how this is a very powerful thing. Long enough in the process so you can, there's any stats that you could give us on this? Like, when you're talking about, okay, our win rate, what does that mean? Can you give us some numbers that might help us kind of chain this down from the intangible?
Yeah, we're starting to do a lot of data analysis here, and it's quite a fun and challenging project. But one recent just post IPO developer tools company that's a customer of Guide, we ran a pretty sophisticated analysis on, and showed about a 214% increase in pass-through rate as a direct result of implementing Guide measured starting at the phone screen through the offer accept rate. So there was a more than doubling of candidates from the same exact amount of pipeline that made it from that first stage through offer accept. And we were able to do that by actually looking at or leaving a sample in their implementation of candidates that were going through the process for across all of the roles. It's quite a large company of a couple thousand employees. And there was a small sample who did not get the guide experience. And so we were able to actually compare apples to both across the exact same interview stages with the exact same interviewers. And so this led to an estimated, we believe, about over 160 extra hires over the course of 12 months that came from the exact same pipeline, right? So a lot of the talk in recruiting these days is focused on increasing top of funnel, which we know a lot about because we started there. But like a product onboarding or a user journey, right? If you aren't converting people through the onboarding flow, you ought to not be too concerned about putting more people in the top of the funnel before you sort of fix the leaky bucket problem. And that's kind of where we focus. We don't help you bring new candidates in top of the funnel. There's awesome other software for that. We help you actually win them once you begin interviewing.
Yeah. So quick question from Chris over on LinkedIn. He said, is this an add-on or a supplement to an ATS? It's a separate product, as I understand, but it will integrate with ATSs. So essentially, I guess ATS integration must be one of the major pain in your proverbial back ends that your product team has to do right now. You've got to integrate like hundreds and hundreds of ATSs, but it's a standalone right now. And how it works is you just upload your recruiting flow through this process. Yeah.
So today, one just clarification there. Today, we work almost exclusively with Greenhouse and Lever as our ATS partners, and we're moving very quickly to add additional ATSs throughout the year. One additional thing that I'll mention is we're launching later this year the no ATS version. This will be the ability to use Guide without any ATS whatsoever. I think the easiest way to conceptualize what Guide is today as it relates to your existing ATS and systems is we view the ATS as your company's window out to your pipeline of candidates. This is how you see your world of candidates. Guide integrates deeply with the ATS to become almost like the external half of the ATS. We are the candidate's window into your company. So as you move a candidate through each stage of your ATS, we automatically update the candidate based on your settings and preferences with the right information for that stage of that role at that time. So this is all pre-set up. You send a candidate a magic link, like a Loom link or something like that. It's their link throughout the process. And then you just work in the ATS as you normally would. And we automatically keep the candidate up to date at the right moments with the right information.
That's the key. Basically, candidate gets a single link and they can get updated on this with the single sort of thing that they go to, and you just carry on working ATS. Once you've configured Guide, you don't need to spend time in Guide. So exactly. You know, it literally will ideally try and disappear from the flow. So this is a super feasible thing. I was about to say this is but I realized it might actually be unethical, but it's a very powerful sales tool sort of mechanism for you to say, hey, listen, we're going to use Guide, but we're going to segment a portion of your candidate flow that aren't in Guide so you can compare. And I think that would be super powerful. But then it occurs to me, hang on, what about those poor candidates that would, you know, love to have the Guide experience, but you know, you're using them as a test case. But I think you could definitely compare, right? Suddenly the customer is going to be convinced that, oh, wow, I can see the difference between the progress and the numbers, then, you know, I think that's gonna be a really high conversion mechanism. But like I say, maybe not the right thing to try. I think one of the key things about ambiguity, and I think you touched on it earlier, Troy, is ambiguity is what creates, I think, the stress in job applications. Because I think most candidates are mature enough to know that they're not going to convert every job application that they apply for. But things get super stressful when you're in queue. You know, you've applied, you've done a test, you've done something, and you're waiting for some sort of thing coming back at you, but you just don't know. Oftentimes you never know. You didn't make the process, you don't get updated, someone else... The only time you know it hasn't happened is because some guy's job's closed, some guy's got the job. And then you think, that is really offensive. It's really annoying because I've just spent all of this ambiguous time, which is when I'm being stressed. And it feels like I've been conned a little bit. So I love the fact that you're leaning into this and plugging it into how this works. Tell me about how much candidate feedback you dealt with. Like, did you work initially with the recruiters to figure out what the problem set was, or did you get into the candidate side? Like, or were you able to infer what the candidate problem was from, you know, working with the recruiters?
A little bit of all of the above. One interesting thing about this problem is that everyone, almost everyone, can relate to it, including us, because we've been through the interview process before. Yeah. So there's a lot of intuitions one might have that are fairly, I think, trustworthy. And that said, we did partner with about 10 organizations who are very interested in being world-class on the candidate experience front in the early days, when we had a sort of alpha product, if you will. And what we did was we met with their recruiting teams for about a half hour every week. And we asked, like, where are you blocked? What is this not doing that you needed to do? And we would knock those things down, ship them by the next week and say, okay, now are you blocked? And so we worked very closely with those customers for almost 6 months in development until it was a matter of the table stakes things being in, guide being fully implemented. And then it's time to sort of layer on the things that the end user might not imagine, but could sort of level up their experience when it comes to, say, analytics or insights. And we also direct candidate feedback as a feature in the guide. And so companies can choose to expose like an Uber-like rating at the interview level. So we ask their candidates, mid-process, hey, how did that interview go and why? It's like a quick 5-star rating and their attributes. It was the interviewer, it was the timeliness, it was the format. The key, though, is that we let the candidate know that we both anonymize their identity, and then we also won't share this with their company until after the hiring decision's made. So this is one of the virtues of being the middle person in the relationship, where the candidate right. wouldn't feel safe sharing this with the company directly because it might impact the hiring decision. We can escrow it and collect it throughout, and then we could give the company really useful information to improve after without it biasing their hiring decision. So this actually is another one of those examples of something that we can do by virtue of being in the middle that benefits actually both sides.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It requires a middleman or a middle person to sit there, because you've got to be honest broker in this. When you're collecting, you know, information that a candidate might feel could prejudice their own application, then of course you can't deliver that directly to the person that may have a wrong opinion on that. So it's understanding. The more I speak to you, Troy, the more clear it is that the understanding of the human psychology is like a key component as to how you do the product dev. And you've already talked about your intensity with working with customers and quick iterations and kind of like really working with the early customers to help build out product. Where did you learn that technique, Troy? Was that something that simply just imbibed into the milieu that you grew up in? You know, you worked in Google, you worked in all of these places. Or was this something that you were formally taught? Like, how did you know how this was the way you wanted to build product?
I'm personally quite a big psychology geek. Spent a lot of my spare time in some literature that would put a lot of people to sleep. I think there was no other way in my head to approach it. Like, we're on a mission that we care deeply about. And again, the solution, the form factor, it's going to change over time. It's less important to us. What really matters is that we're able to bring transparency and humanity into the hiring process. And so just think about that, right? Like, we need to, like, our whole point of view is that candidates aren't numbers. Candidates are making a life decision. Candidates' decision to join your company is going to probably be a more impactful one for them and their life than your decision as a company to hire them. You will hire multiple candidates. A given job seeker will only hire one company or one employer, if you will. And so this is a massive decision from the point of view of the candidate. And so it begs for a more human experience. And a lot of people liken recruiting to sales. I think that there is a ton of there's a great analog there. There's so much that is similar, but I think when we're buying products, it's a lot less personal. It's a lot less tied to our identity. It's a lot less tied to our future and our value and our fulfillment deep in the deepest depths of our, you know, mind and hearts. And so I think when we think about the differences between recruiting and sales, I think maybe, yes, we're operating on top of a funnel structure and we need to look at data and be data informed. But I think that it's critical that we understand that humans are emotional beings and our feelings matter and we want to feel fulfilled, and the things that are motivating us aren't always what are on the outside. And so in order to run a really effective candidate experience and recruiting process, it requires at the center of it all a deep care for the human on the other side. And so I think if you just start with that curiosity, you end up realizing like the software's kind of got to get out of the way. What really matters here is the information that's being shared, the questions that are being asked, the care for delivering the answers to the questions that this person actually cares about, right? We could give them comp data all day long, but maybe they're looking for like the relationship they're going to have with their colleagues or their manager, and comp is like down the bottom of their list. Well, that's a great question to ask at the top of the process.
You know what? It's just, again, fascinating to get a deeper understanding as to your commitment to this, you know, the human side of it. I think you're absolutely right. There's hidden asymmetries in the recruiting process that a lot of recruiters don't even think about. You talk about the level of commitment. Yeah, the commitment is at a different level. A candidate is committing this much. Employer is committing this much. Actually, a lot more like this. Because the employer is hiring lots more people. They have a lot more control, firstly. They're not making huge lifestyle changes, particularly in the pre-COVID era more so, because when people had to relocate, they had to go to the office, possibly change commute, maybe get out of a different, you know, move to a different country, all this type of stuff. That's huge. Companies' HQ is still where the HQ is. They're not doing anything, you know? So there's an asymmetry of risk, which we, you know, this is the first time I've spoke to anybody that talked about this. I've been working in recruitment 20 years. So it's something we simply have ignored and not thought about in any way. And another thing I think is significant is kind of the asymmetry of power also, you know, because candidate coming into a traditional recruiting funnel is basically subjecting themselves to a sequence of judgments by the employer that's going to decide whether they're good enough or not. And if you think about that, you know, I voluntarily go through a process where a bunch of strangers are going to look at me and think whether I'm good enough for them. How is that ever going to be a good candidate experience? There's no way that's going to be good for me. I don't like being judged, guess what? So with something like Guide, it just rebalances that asymmetry a little bit. Because the candidate can at least then make choices and have a bit more control. Super interesting. Let's talk about sort of how you go about building your business. I guess this is the next big thing you've got to think about, Troy. You just raised a bunch of money. You need to, I guess, expand the team and grow the team. How are you planning to do that? A lot of people kind of think, right, great, of course we're going to start filling all these gaps that we need to fill in. How conscious are you in terms of how you want to grow the business, what kind of culture you want to develop in the company, and how does that inform your hiring approach?
Yeah, we try to be as intentional as we can, but I'm learning and haven't done this past this stage before myself. So it's a learning experience for me. And I think a lot of what led us to Guide from these pivots, if you will, in prior years, as you mentioned, the walking away from a good business that already existed, it wasn't really our desire to chase another object. It was our desire to land on something that both was a good business and like really connected with our values. And for me, that was certainly my personal story. We had good businesses, but I was less connected to the like why and the impact they were having. And I really wanted to just sort of wiggle my way into being able to live a life where we were doing both. And so that's really the center of our hiring philosophy. It's we're a mission driven startup. And that means that in a lot of ways, I like to say, you know, money money is not why we do this. We want to make money and be a profitable for-profit enterprise so we can do more of our art. We don't want to do our art so we can make more money. And I think that that framing matters a lot. And it changes the way a whole culture develops. And so we want to hire people who see the result, the short-term results, the financials, the sales, the deals as fuel to getting to have more of the impact that we're here to have. We don't want to go have an impact so we can accumulate more fuel. And this is the philosophy upon which I'd say we aim to hire, which is people who are deeply passionate and resonant with the problem, who then have the skill sets that can make an impact. And so very often in our process, like, you know, the candidates that end up joining us are folks who have had really poor experiences as candidates before, or have been hiring managers, say, or recruiters who have gone through great lengths to treat people the way they deserve to be treated and realize how hard that is to do, even if you have the desire to do it. And so it really starts there. And I think from a cultural standpoint, the details, as long as we get that part right, empower the people around us. And like, I'm learning every day. We bring somebody new in, they have opinions. Like, we want them to express those and change things. And, you know, I'm a big fan at this stage of, you know, pushing back on the folks that say, you know, what's your culture like? We'd say, look, at this stage, whatever you want it to be like, right? You're a significant portion of it. And so wherever there are gaps, fill them. We're hiring you so you can bring your DNA into ours. That is what it's about. And so this is a morphing fluid equation that we want to look very different in a year. And I don't know what that will look like, but I'm excited to see.
You know, you keep saying things that I've never heard before, Troy. And I think it is fascinating. That's exactly like the recognition of the moment, in the sense that this is a moment of change also for the group of people that are currently Guide. And in 12 months time, it will be a very different business. And you know, you need like the preparedness to understand that the culture is going to change and morph and grow, mutate, if you will, if you want to use, I use the word positively, is a part of how this is going to be. It's like an organic approach to it, rather than something that's overly engineered. Moving on to your hiring decisions yourself, Troy, you're a CEO of the business. I guess by now in your journey, you probably have a little bit of an inkling as to the kind of CEO things that you like to do and the sort of CEO things that you don't like to do. What are those things? Like, what are you good at as in this role, and what are you not so good at?
I think the latter list is quite a bit longer. I'm still learning a lot about myself. And the more we work with new people and grow this team, like, the more I get to explore this question. So jury's out. I love this. I love talking to people about why we believe, what we believe and why. And I love talking with people who agree and people who disagree for reasons that are interesting and persuasive, that help us harden our thinking. I love recruiting. I would love to think that I'm decent at it. And I view it to be one of the core parts of my role. I view that my job is not to like sort of sit at some helm and like see around some corners that others can't see. Like, my job is just to say over and over what mission we're on, and then convince the smartest people that we can find, those that are way better at me than at any of these given functions, to join. And then therefore that creates actually its own unique role that I could be really good at. And I started my career in recruiting actually after a stint, a minor in the States in computer science. And I learned through that I wanted to build a company and a software company, but wow, I'm definitely shouldn't be the one building the product. Like, you don't really want me anywhere near the code. I learned that much through that process. And so then I started asking this sort of big life question at the time, which is, if I'm not building the product, like, what's the thing I could be world-class at? That would actually make me worthy of being on a founding team. Like, I could bring value to an early beginning seed of a company. Well, what is that? And it took me a minute until I tripped and fell into recruiting accidentally, as one does. And it all happened at once for me conceptually, which is, there is a role that itself is bringing the best people together around one common goal. And like, that's what I want to be world-class at. So I see that at the tip of the spear for me. The rest of the stuff is like, outside of keeping everybody caffeinated or virtually caffeinated these days, making sure our goals are aligned, leading with context and not control. I'm a big fan of Reed Hastings' philosophy, where we set really crystal clear goals as a company and then let everybody own their path there. You have total creative freedom. We know what the end state is. I don't want to have an opinion about the way in which you get there. That's your job. And fundraising, telling our story, learning more about marketing and getting our philosophy out there, because I think, you know, we're not just really selling software. We're trying to sell like a change in the way that we think about recruiting. We're trying to raise the standard, change the norm, and sort of we got to make a business case for why treating people better is good for the bottom line. And I think we can make that case, but more than the business case, we just believe it's like the right thing to do.
You know what? That's fascinating again, Troy, because I speak to a lot of CEOs, a lot of people have actually been on the show already. And I know it from personality point of view, they're so different. Their traits are different. Their motivations are different. The things they enjoy are different. All of them are super smart. All of them can do all of the bits, but they obviously would lean into the stuff that they prefer to do. And your side, I think you're one of the few CEOs that I think is very cognizant of the kind of the need to evangelize and to be market facing, I call it. So it's not so, some CEOs super operational, like they literally turn into the company and optimize the bits or within the business. Whereas I think your approach is very much, let's put the pin in the map here. We need to get there and then talk to the industry and get them all pointing in that same direction. And I think, I don't know what your thoughts are, but with regards to how, you know, obviously our consumption of media and how we kind of lean into things, how we make decisions based on the information we get, I think the externally facing side of it, I think will become increasingly more important component of leadership as we go forward. Because your ability to kind of create the story, to build a narrative and to build momentum around it, I think is a key part to business success. It's no longer a case where I'm going to build a product quietly and then hope, you know, the market simply gets it. No, you've got to sell the damn story. You've got to present the story to them and tell it in a compelling way.
Yeah, no doubt. It reminds me, I'm trying to recall who I'm citing this from or what book references this, but the counter example here is like, you know, Marlboro back in the day needed like, I think it was Marlboro, the Camel, whatever cigarette company needed the Camel to sort of like personify the brand. And it was because they kind of needed to like say it something other than what they were selling. They got a spin. And I think in precisely the opposite terms, which is like, our job is to just be transparent, right? Like our job of marketing, like marketing at Guide and marketing, I think increasingly into the future with business in general, is about just creating more of a sort of window into what it is that you're doing and why. And so it's less a fabrication of a story. There will always be framing effects and language games and, you know, a level of eloquence that we can do it with. But I think that the starting point is just finding a way to let people, the outside world, your customers, in on what it is you're doing and why. And if that's resonant, the rest follows.
You know, I think this is a really kind of important point worth crystallizing a little bit. But the boundary, I think, between a company and the market is starting to become more transparent. And the companies, I mean, I'm old enough to know 20 years, 25 years ago, that was a solid wall, man. I mean, literally, the market could not see what was going on inside the business. You literally had no idea. You'd have to have a drink with somebody, you know, who worked there and have in the bar type conversation for you to have any knowledge whatsoever. The social media started changing this because suddenly we started connecting with people that work for different companies. Back in the day, you would not actually even know anybody that worked for a different company. You're locked into your own employer for 40 hours a week, and everyone who was in your competitor space would be a hostile. You'd not speak to them. You'd not deal with them. So social media changed it, and I think it's changing now again, where people are recognizing that to erect kind of a barrier and to constantly have to cultivate the kind of a fake image is just exhausting. It's exhausting, it doesn't work, and it's easily discredited because you can't control the information. People are going to talk. So you're better off just being open right from the get-go and just showing how you operate. That's the way in which you're going to win with the candidates that want to work with you. I mean, you know, that's it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's for the same broader macro problem we're talking about is very much, I think, it's the bleeding edge of recruiting today. It's no longer about like tricking folks into joining and then finding out what's on the other side of the curtain, right? That those people are going to leave because they have a lot of opportunity now and they have a lot of access. And it used to be that the only jobs available to us were the ones that were within walking distance of our house down the block. And now I can interview for jobs in, you know, countries that I'll never visit before and work for companies remotely who my team is folks who I'd never meet in person. I mean, the level of options has dramatically increased, which gives folks power. And with that power to the candidate and the employee comes a higher need and demand for more information.
A couple of yes, no questions, Troy, that, you know, I think the audience should be interested in. Is there a number of stages that is optimal for a good candidate experience?
No, I don't have a strong, I haven't seen a lot of evidence that there's a particular number, but communicating whatever that number is upfront to set the expectation is.
Yep. Okay. What about the overall commitment of time that the candidate might be expected to put into a process? Is there something there?
No hard rule, but generally, the more you ask, the more you should give. And so if you are asking a candidate to put in, you know, X amount of hours on a project at a point where you haven't invested a lot yourself as a business, that's a pretty poor experience. If you've asked for a significant project to be done and you've also offered for to make 5 intros to folks on the team they'd work with ahead of time or in parallel for them to speak with and learn more about the company, but that's a much more equal ask.
Yeah, so some really basic, again, human psychology, right? You're talking about equal exchange. I talk about reciprocity a lot in the sense that it's all just reflect back the energy that you're asking the candidate. If you're like giving zero energy, you can expect zero energy back. That's actually a fair process. You know, that's actually fair. What is unfair if you load up a 6-hour test at the application stage or something?
Right.
No, that's not fair. Given nothing.
And the results will show these days. I think that's what's interesting. And 10 years ago, you can kind of do that because the employer was in power. I think nowadays you'll see candidates voting with their time and their feet.
Yeah, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. Yep. So right now, where does this expand to, Troy? I mean, it sounds like the entire concept of transparency and kind of putting the human back into the process could be applied to almost any particular sort of scenario where people join companies. But right now it's sitting probably, I guess, in more tech side, I guess, because that's where typically things get built first. But what are the next sort of segments that you're looking to tackle?
Yeah, we're already seeing a pretty interesting propagation of Guide through from tech companies into, you know, I mean, every company today is to some degree a tech company. So we're seeing those who adopted us initially to serve, say, you know, high skill labor roles like software engineering or sales folks or marketers. We're seeing those same folks, customers like One Medical and Glossier are now implementing Guide for clinicians or retail associates for the Glossier's real retail stores, for example. So really, if you're doing a lot of hiring, hiring is competitive at all the levels today. I mean, you can go to the local like coffee shop and they're struggling to have the people to serve demand. And so as long as there's a lot of hiring being done, I think that Guide is relevant today. You know, we'll continue to explore how far and wide we can make that impact. I think we have a pretty big interest in being fairly sector and domain agnostic because this experience is pretty bad at the moment for a lot of folks. It tends to get even worse at volume when there's thousands of applicants for a given role. That happens in sort of the blue collar markets and such, where you just don't even, you're applying to 100 jobs and there's just no feedback loop. You don't know whether anyone's even looking at it, let alone whether you'd hear back.
Yeah, and unfortunately they accept it, and which exacerbates the problem because then candidates overapply because they assume there's no response. So they actually end up applying for jobs that they probably have moderate interest in, and it just like adds more crap data into the system. So we need to recreate that trust with the candidates so that, you know, when they apply to a job, they know that it will be reviewed and, you know, they'll get an update. That's like basic stuff. So, but it's basic stuff that we simply haven't been able to solve as an industry. So great to see innovation like this on it. Troy, I got to say, $8 million raised. Like, how are you going to spend the money? Like, have you thought about, okay, here's $8 million. $1 million goes here, $2 million goes there. How do you actually do that as a CEO?
We're just going to buy a bunch of NFTs, I think, is what I'm hearing. don't tell our investors that. We are tripling our headcount at the moment from about a dozen to 30 something this year alone. And so we'll invest across the board and continued integrations with more ATSs as we've spoken about. Our whole go-to-market functions, which we're building really from scratch, and our product roadmap is pretty exciting. We're today almost like a broadcast mechanism for the company to the candidate. We're a place where the candidate can sort of consume information about the job they're interviewing for. And a lot of where we're interested in going as a product is moving and evolving from just communication to collaboration, which is really a two-way information sharing space where candidates can equally share, ask, and explore back with the company during the process. Today we have breadcrumbs of that experience, and we're hoping to explore what that would look like in full-blown form where both the company and the candidate have this sort of genuine partnership where they can collaborate through this process. So we're quite excited about that. And we're hiring across the board. So, anybody who's interested, we'd love to chat. And again, if it's a problem that excites you, I think that it'd be worth the conversation.
As an ex-recruiter, Troy, do you feel the responsibility to do the recruiting, or do you have any help doing that? I mean, I think it's one of those things where you get pulled into stuff that you know how to do, right? So how are you handling the growth of your own business right now?
Yeah, in clumsy fashion. I love recruiting. I love being involved in the process. One of the most gratifying parts of my job is like bringing new people into the company. It's really rewarding for me personally. I also think though that because I have a recruiting background, I probably have some bad habits that aren't strengths. I also probably have like a hard, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know syndrome. So we actually just brought in our first founding recruiter. Her name's Maddie. She's awesome. Was a very happy, excited user of Guide and customer of Guide for quite some time. And we're really excited to have her on board. I think partnering with her moving forward, like we're open question, like how we'll recruit at scale. It's one thing to build a team to 15 or 20, which we did with Resource, but getting to pass that stage, I think will be a new territory, and I'll be a new territory myself. But I imagine it's hard to imagine, I should say, ever being completely out of the recruiting process. That would just be just a sad day, I think, for me.
It's sad, but also maybe irresponsible as a manager, as the helmsman of a recruiting tech platform, right? So it's almost like, hey, I should actually keep a little bit of a hand in to understand a little bit how that flow works. I'm assuming that the Guide recruiting process, will it change, do you think, to adapt to the scale? And if so, how is it going to change?
Yeah, it's a great question that I didn't note, which is like, it's critical that me and others at our company are involved in the recruiting process because we're living and dogfooding the philosophy and this team-wide collaborative candidate experience that we preach. That said, we have already made significant bets in pretty progressive areas with our own recruiting process and the use of Guide ourselves. And so we kind of view ourselves as the petri dish of experimentation for future customers. So a lot of our own early alpha features and such are put into play in our own recruiting process because we can see directly how this impacts the candidate. That said, loosely speaking, over about three quarters of our entire interview experience from top to bottom with Guide is asynchronous. For example, one of the, our version of an onsite isn't just migrated conversation, synchronous conversation to Zoom. Our version of an onsite happens entirely in a Google document with our whole team involved and the candidate. And the candidate's answering questions in the Google Doc with our whole team, people from various parts of the company actually collaborating with them in comments, asking further questions. So we're all looking at the exact same information. We're not biased by the charisma or the accent or the gender of the person, but we're actually all looking at exactly the same information. It's not a summary or notes. And we're in the same space together. And so we found this to be incredibly useful for us as a company, but also just a really positive experience for candidates who can jump in whenever they want. At night, the next day, do a piece here, do a piece there. We can eliminate the whole logistics of scheduling. I mean, it's been just a really illuminating experiment for us that's working well. And a lot of these elements we hope to build into our products.
That's fascinating. I mean, again, Troy, the more I speak with you, the more I realize you're a cultural radical, man. Like everything you're doing is like so innovative. And I think maybe that's just a habitual thing that you've brought to how this business works. It's highly experimental, prepared to test, you almost remind me of those like early 18th century scientists that were trying to figure out polio vaccines and stuff and like injecting themselves with it. But I'm thinking, you know what? Sometimes you got to do it, right? You got to do the experiment, test it, and then have the confidence that it's going to work and then see how it plays out. So I'd actually love to hear, I don't know whether Maddie's up for it, but it would be great maybe at some point to, you know, get her thinking as to how some of these more radical experiments play out and, you know, how to actually do the experiment. I mean, a lot of companies, I think, are a little bit frozen with the experimentation thing. Like they don't understand how to run an experiment, or maybe they fear it more than they should, because most of the time experiments is do first and then you know, get in there and then sort of in an immersive fashion rather than over design and you know, over plan, which I still think is the predominant way in which recruiting and TA tends to work. So to get a little bit of that juice, that kind of like give it a shot type of thing, I think would be super useful. Okay, Troy, listen, we're coming to the end of the show, so I just wanted to ask you two more questions. Firstly, for any kind of wannabe entrepreneurs out there that are kind of thinking, hey, maybe this is a path I want to take at some point, do you have any input or advice or observations that this person might find useful? If there's like one point you would make to that person, what would it be?
Just start. I had no idea what we were doing, but I was married to the problem. I'd say find a problem that you feel you can work on for 5 years, that even if you don't, if you don't see the success you hope, you'd still feel it was worth the time. Because when things go downward in the first few years, of which they always will, you need to be just excited enough and motivated enough about the problem that you persist through. And so pick something that you're really excited about. Don't get too hung up on the solution. It will probably change as you morph. But what problem are you really passionate about? And then just start. You can start while you're at a job. You can start doing a little bit. And I think the feedback and the data, the world feeding you back how well it thinks of your idea, the people around you talking about it, doing it, get it out there. That is the fuel that will pull you in further. And so you just got to start getting it.
I love it. I'm going to go back to this and probably snippet that piece because I think it's really worth sitting in on. Focus on the problem. Don't worry about the solution. That's going to change. Lean into something that you really care about, because that's going to basically sustain you through the times where it isn't going so great. And by the way, folks, just a quick reminder, Troy was actually running a parallel business, like adjacent to the problem and actually solving a part of that problem. So he was generating revenue to do it. So it wasn't a big sacrifice. What I hate to see is when I see people doing entrepreneurial journey and they're mortgaging their houses and they're taking like ridiculous risks. Don't do that. You know, do something that kind of continues the revenue stream, but make sure it's adjacent to this huge, this wider problem that you're trying to play with. And then you won't be taking irrational risks. Okay, Troy, this is the end of the show. What kind of busy CEO things are you off to do now?
I'm jumping into a sales demo in 1 minute.
Okay, I think you're going to close that sale, don't you guys? Troy, good luck with that sale. Good luck with the demo. Good luck with everything you're doing. Fantastic to see the raise. Well done and everything. And we'll catch up soon, man.
Thanks so much. Big fan of the show. I really appreciate you having me.
Take care, man.
See ya.
Wasn't that great, folks? What an interesting and inspirational guy. I kind of known Troy kind of just digitally, but the first time I actually spoke to him today. But I could have continued to have that conversation, I think, for another several hours. Lots to learn, especially about this deep interest in human psychology. I think that underpins so many of the problems we're trying to fix in recruiting. And yes, Michael, I think getting Troy into Brain Food Lab would be very interesting as well. Okay, that's about it, folks. Thanks for watching. If you're interested in Founders Focus, by the way, I'm more or less doing this every week. It seems like we're really stacked with people that want to do this. So follow the channel. You'll see it more or less every Wednesday. And also we're doing Brain Food Lab on Friday, of course. We're talking about the candidate experience report on Friday. So kind of really adjacent and aligned really with what Troy was talking about. But basically, what has been the priority shift from candidates in 2021 to 2022? So make sure you register for that if you want to see the show. Okay, that's about it. Thanks for watching, everybody. Have a good day.